Welcome to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Ben Glass Law and Virginia appellate attorney Steve Emmert. Listening to oral arguments from the Supreme Court of Virginia is one of the best ways to stay abreast of both substantive and procedural law. And today's smart lawyers know that any case, even if it is outside their practice area, can offer a learning opportunity. So, listen, enjoy, subscribe, and leave us feedback.
Mr. Webb, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andy Webb, and I represent the appellants Herbert Towns and David Silvestro on their appeal to this court. We believe the trial court erred in three distinct ways. First, the trial court erred by instructing the jury that it was the Commonwealth's burden of proof to show that the defendants should be removed from their positions on the City of Hopewell Local Electoral Board by a preponderance of the evidence, rather than by showing of clear and convincing evidence. The question of burden of proof in a proceeding for removal of a public official was clearly decided by this court in 1953 in its case, Commonwealth ex rel Davis v. Malbon. The trial court erred by directly contradicting that express and on-court ruling. The Malbon court held, because a removal proceeding is highly penal in nature, the burden is on the Commonwealth to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant is guilty of one or more of the charges enumerated in the statute and set out in the complaint. Despite this clear ruling, the trial court, without elaborating on its reasons, determined pre-trial that the burden of proof was on the Commonwealth by a preponderance of the evidence. For over 100 years, the court has held that removal proceedings are both highly penal in nature and quasi-criminal. And in fact, in 2011, in Johnson v. Woodward, this court directly quoted Warren, which was the predecessing case on which Malbon built, for the proposition that a removal proceeding is, quote, one which is primarily public in its nature, which, although not a criminal case, is one highly penal in its nature, and one which the Commonwealth is the plaintiff party. So it's this nature of the proceeding and the relief that's sought through the proceeding that requires the higher burden of proof. By ignoring the unique qualities and instructing the jury that the Commonwealth's burden was by a preponderance of the evidence, the trial court directly contradicted this court's longstanding ruling and reasoning for Malbon. The State Board of Elections argued both to the trial court and on appeal to this court that the underlying charges somehow have an effect on the standard of proof. Again, that's not the case because of the nature of the proceeding and the relief sought. But even if the underlying charges somehow have effect on the burden of proof, the grounds for removal articulated in the modern statute, which is 24.2-233, in the 1950 statute analyzed by Malbon, which is 15-500, are substantially equivalent. The Virginia State Board of Elections argues that 24.2-233, the modern statute, does not require a showing of knowing or willful misconduct, where the 1950 statute did. This ignores the long line of cases from Warren to Malbon into the present, and the fact that the statute now is the same statute from 1919, which was emphasized in Johnson and Woodward, and that's exemplified by the first paragraph of the Malbon opinion, where the court notes that the petition for removal argued that Malbon was guilty of malfeasance, misfeasance, incompetency, and gross neglect of official duty in his office as said sheriff, and has knowingly and willfully neglected to perform duties enjoined upon such sheriff by the laws of the state. Those five statutory grounds are the exact statutory grounds cited by the Warren case and examined by the Warren case. And the Warren court specifically said that no specific or affirmative willful misconduct is required to remove an individual under those statutes. So overall, it's our position at the assignment of error number one, that it's the specific nature of the removal proceeding and the relief sought by that removal proceeding that places this case in a unique position and requires the higher standard of proof. Therefore, because the nature of the removal proceeding and this court's directed on-court ruling in Malbon, that the burden of proof in a removal proceeding is on the Commonwealth by a preponderance of the evidence, the trial court committed reversible error by instructing the jury otherwise, and we ask the court grant the appellate the release Dalton's petition. On to assignment error number two. We believe the trial court erred in allowing the Virginia State Board of Elections to expand its grounds for removal beyond the grounds sworn to in its petition for removal. In its petition, Virginia State Board of Elections alleged that the Hopewell Electoral, quote, the Hopewell Electoral Board met on at least three occasions, April 2nd, 12th, and 23rd, without providing proper notice of the meeting to the public as required by the Virginia Freedom of Information Act, and that's paragraph six of the petition for removal. And it also generally alleged that the appellants failed to follow FOIA's open meeting requirements, and that's in the introductory paragraph and paragraph 25A. It's important to note, I think, for the court that all of these allegations involve meeting notices, whether it was the specific April window or the general allegations. Now, Virginia Code 24.2-235 requires that all petitions for the removal of a public official be signed by the person making them under the penalty of perjury. And because of the highly penal and quasi-criminal nature of a removal proceeding, these statutes must be strictly construed. Essentially, 24.2-235 requires all of the allegations brought before the judge to be sworn to by those bringing forward the petition. And additionally, as I discussed previous with assignment of error number one, the Malbon court specifically stated that it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove that the respondents are guilty of one or more of the charges enumerated in the removal statute and set forth in the complaint, which here would be the petition for removal. Despite the limited allegations contained in the petition for removal, 9 days prior to trial and after the conclusion of discovery, Virginia State Board of Elections asked and the trial court allowed the board to introduce evidence concerning meeting notices outside of that April window, and more importantly, evidence concerning the creation, retention, and publication of meeting minutes and agendas. Those were allegations that were not sworn to by the Virginia State Board of Elections as required by 24.2-235. And because the trial court allowed the Virginia State Board of Elections to improperly expand upon its FOIA petition and introduce FOIA evidence outside of those allegations, we believe the trial court committed reversible error. And finally, moving on to assignment of error three, we believe the trial court erred in excluding various defense evidence, which was relevant in the jury's determination of whether the appellants neglected their duty, misused their office, or were incompetent in their performance, and whether that alleged negligence, misuse, or incompetence had a material adverse effect on the conduct of the Hopewell Electoral Board. And that's the standard from 24.2-233. The evidence that was excluded was both substantive and impeachment. Generally, there was three types of evidence which were arguing were improperly excluded here today. First was evidence of the appellant's training, which the Virginia State Board of Elections is required to give the appellant's training under 24.2-103. Second were two independent reports that were the JLARC report and the GREB report. These independent reports showed, among other things, that the board wasn't properly training local electoral board members or even properly providing them with a job description. And finally, we believe evidence of political affiliation of certain witnesses was also improperly excluded. To the first type of evidence that was excluded concerning training, by excluding that evidence, the trial court required the jury to decide both prongs of 24.2-233 in a vacuum. The question for the jury to decide was not whether the appellants failed to do some job duty. It was that whether the appellant's conduct met the standard for removal under 24.2-233. At trial, the state board established their duties incumbent upon the local electoral board members by introducing a copy of the electoral board job description. But that job description provides no context at all for how a local board member was supposed to do his jobs as articulated in the job description. For example, it states that a member must ensure the creation, production, and proper custody of ballots. But again, that provides no context. And at the trial, the Virginia State Board argued that the appellants neglected their duty during the process of creating, proof ballot. The fact that respondents did not receive any training concerning the creation or submission of the ballots to the board was certainly relevant to the jury's determination of both prongs of 24.2-233, whether they neglected a duty, misused their office, or incompetence in the performance of a duty, and then whether that neglect, misuse, or incompetence had a material adverse effect on the office. Second, the exclusion of the two relevant reports, the JLARC report and the Greb report, also established the circumstances under which these individuals were working and went towards both prongs of 24.2-233, as well as the fact that it also went to the motive and bias of certain witnesses at trial. One of those reports was released, the JLARC report was released 10 days before the board filed its petition. It was talked about in depth prior to voting to remove these two individuals or to bring forward the removal petition to remove these individuals. And we believe that it was important to show certain bias and motive of the Virginia State Board of Elections witnesses. And then finally, the third class, political affiliation, the trial court's pretrial exclusion of the witness's political affiliation precluded the appellants from discussing politics in the highly political case and showing certain witnesses' political bias and motive. Now, based on all three of those assignments of error, we move this court to either remand the case for retrial or in the alternative, we ask that this court issue an order vacating the jury's ruling and dismissing the charges against the appellants with prejudice. And we ask for that latter relief because this is kind of a unique issue where the appellants, they've been removed from the board for over a year. Local electoral board members are appointed for 3 years, and Mr. Towns was appointed in 2017, and his time on the board was, it expired on February 29th, 2020, and Mr. Silvestro's is scheduled to end in February 2021. And the local electoral board members that are now on the board in Hopewell, they fully comply with 24.2-106. The two replacements, you know, they were appointed through that the same process as outlined in 24.2-106. They meet all the legal requirements, and they've served as member on the board for over a year. Therefore, because of Mr. Towns' position and the position of the current members, we believe that it may be in the best interest to, rather than to go back down to the lower court and retry Mr. Towns and Mr. Silvestro, just to vacate the jury's verdict and dismiss the quasi-criminal charges against the appellants with prejudice. Thank you, and I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You have 2 minutes and 49 seconds.
Thank you.
Would you hire an appellate lawyer to handle your jury trial? Of course not. Trying cases requires a different focus, a different way of speaking, even a different way of thinking from handling appeals. So why would you ask a trial lawyer to handle your appeal? When it comes time to appear in an appellate court, trust a lawyer who specializes in appeals only. Steve Emmert limits his practice to appeals. Other lawyers consult him when they face tough problems in the appellate maze. Focus on what you do best. Call Steve Emmert at 757-965-5021 direct to find out how he can help you. Again, that's Steve Emmert at 757-965-5021.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Michelle Talon for the State Board of Elections. I'm ready to begin if the court is ready.
You may proceed. May it please...
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Appellants Herbert Towns and David Silvestro swore an oath to faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all duties incumbent upon them. They did not abide by that oath, and they were therefore removed from office. Your Honors, the evidence in the case was overwhelming. In fact, when considering whether to petition for removal, the State Board of Elections chairman stated that in his term, he had never received such a large volume of complaints for any locality. The petition for removal was filed, appellants received a 2-day jury trial, and they were removed from office. Now, my friend on the other side assigns 3 errors to the decision below, and I'd like to address them in turn. First, as to the burden of proof, appellants asked for and received broad civil discovery below. consistent with the decision to grant broad civil discovery, the circuit court held that the civil burden of proof applies preponderance of the evidence. And that makes sense. This court has been clear that preponderance of the evidence is the default burden of proof when the legislature does not set forth a more onerous standard. The legislature did not set forth a more onerous burden of proof for the statutory scheme here, and therefore preponderance of evidence was the proper standard. Now, my friend on the other side relies heavily on this court's decision in Malbon. But Malbon itself was very clear that the statutory framework is central to the analysis. And in the statutory framework here, the General Assembly did not depart from the default burden of proof in civil cases. Notably, Malbon predates by more than six decades this court's decision in Bala, wherein this court set forth the general framework examining burdens of proof. In Bala, this court refused to apply a heightened burden of proof to the Virginia Consumer Protection Act, absent an express statement of such intent by the General Assembly. Like in Bala, there was no express statement of a heightened burden of proof here, and therefore preponderance of evidence is the proper burden of proof. In any event, the evidence against the appellants was overwhelming and would easily surpass a heightened burden of proof. And I would like to draw the court's attention to two glaring improprieties. First, appellants' insistence on using non-uniform ballots, specifically ballots that have some candidates' names in all capital letters and other names not in capital letters. And second, the FOIA violation. As to the first violation, the code requires uniformity in elections, but appellants nevertheless insisted on non-uniform ballots. The elections administrator for the Department of Elections was clear on both August 2nd, 2018, and separately again on August 6th, that it is the position of the Department of Elections that a request to have one's name printed on the ballot in all capital letters does not adhere to the ballot standard, and if permitted, could present an advantage to one candidate over another. If you allow different cases, some candidates' letters, names in all capital letters and others not, the loser could, quote, contest the election. Despite these clear instructions and despite the code's requirement of uniformity, appellants still decided to vote to include the improper and non-uniform ballot. I also recommend that this court watch the video that's part of the record in this case. And appellants themselves in their brief refer to this video as a, quote, key piece of evidence. It's only 2 minutes long, but it's very instructive as to what occurred with the ballots here. The third member of the board in the video described appellants' insistence on using the non-uniform ballots as, quote, insane. And he said in the video, why wouldn't we let one candidate have an unfair advantage? It is up to us as the electoral board to make sure that it is a fair and smooth election. Appellants nevertheless insisted on voting for non-uniform ballots. But the vote on the ballots was not the only problem. Time and again, appellants failed to provide the transparency required by FOIA. They repeatedly failed to notice meetings to the public, they did not have proper agendas, and they did not maintain meeting minutes. In fact, they even held meetings excluding the third board member. So even if there was an error in the burden of proof, and there was not one here, it would still be harmless because the evidence at trial was more than sufficient to meet even a heightened burden of proof. As to the second assignment of error, appellants argue that the circuit court abused its discretion in expanding the petition for removal by allowing evidence on FOIA violations. But there was no expansion of the petition for removal here. The petition was explicitly based on FOIA violations. For example, the very first page of the petition for removal states appellants, quote, actively and repeatedly disregarded FOIA by holding meetings without prior notice to the community, and in some cases without prior notice to the third member of the Hopewell Electoral Board. Later on, the petition for removal expressly notes, quote, repeated failures to follow FOIA and open meetings requirements. Then the petition for removal goes on to list three examples when the board met without providing proper notice of the meetings to the public as required by FOIA, stating that the board met and that appellants met on, quote, at least three occasions where they met without giving notice, indicating that there were more than those three meetings. And I think it's important to also look at the evidence supporting the petition for removal, because that included examples of specific FOIA violations. For example, there was an email from the vice mayor for the city of Hopewell explaining that appellants were unable to produce prior meetings, notices, agendas, or minutes. There was also evidence of complaints from the State Board of Elections commissioner that he received FOIA violations, and that's at JA 138. The petition for removal also includes instances where appellants met without the third board member. Given the FOIA violation in the petition for removal and the numerous examples of FOIA violations in the evidence included in the petition for removal, it was certainly not an abuse of discretion for the circuit court to read the petition for removal as encompassing FOIA violations beyond the three dates specifically enumerated as examples. But in any event, even restricting the analysis to the three dates enumerated as examples is sufficient to affirm the decision below. Finally, as to the third assignment of error, appellants argue that the circuit court abused its discretion in prohibiting an introduction of other evidence. The evidence at issue, such as evidence about training or reports critical of state entities, does not provide a defense to removal for office. At best, it could be mitigation evidence. In other words, appellant's duty to the people of Hopewell was not contingent on their training. And similarly, the other evidence, such as political party affiliation, was highly prejudicial. The circuit court did not abuse its discretion in prohibiting introduction of this evidence. Because the circuit court did not abuse its discretion in prohibiting introduction of certain evidence, and because the circuit court properly applied the default burden of proof, no new trial is warranted here. Unless the court has any questions, we ask that you affirm. Thank you.
All right, it appears there are no further questions. Rebuttal, 2 minutes and 49 seconds, if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first address the state's argument regarding harmless error. I think most importantly, the standard is the court assumes that unless presented with contradictory evidence, that when a jury is incorrectly instructed as to the law, the jury relied on the incorrect instruction in coming to its verdict. And that was, you know, the burden of proof, I think, is a very important instruction for the jury. I mean, it's the level that the state had to prove its case. And additionally, I think that there was sufficient evidence produced at trial where a reasonable jury could have determined that the respondents were acting in a reasonable manner and that didn't have a material adverse effect on the office in Hopewell. At trial, the appellants produced evidence that the ballots were being resubmitted to Virginia State Board of Elections to get additional advice on the contradiction between the candidate forms, which said that all names should be written as they appear on the ballot, and the best practices. It wasn't a law, a statutory law. It wasn't a regulatory issue. It was a best practice from the Virginia State Board of Elections to have all of the candidates' names in mixed case. And so there was a contradiction there, and there was evidence introduced that said, we are submitting these ballots to the state board for their advice on what to do moving forward. So I don't think it's as cut and dry as the state wants to argue here. In terms of the Balal case, we cite on brief and continue to maintain here that this statute is the same general statutory scheme that was interpreted from 1919 forward that's reinforced by the Johnson v. Woodward case. And I think that that's extraordinarily important that this court and lower courts as well have looked to those. They may be older cases, but have looked to those older cases over the years when interpreting 24.2-233 and 235. And finally, I believe the state, they started off their argument by talking about the oath. We're not disputing that the oath, that our clients took that oath and they were required to uphold the Constitution of the state of Virginia. What we are saying is that violation of that oath does not constitute removal. Removal is 24.2-233 requires that two-part analysis by the jury to determine if removal is proper. And for those reasons, we ask that the court...
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. The court will take a recess and will resume hearings at 11:15. The counsel who are to argue need to be in the queue at 11 o'clock.
Thank you for tuning in to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. My name is Ben Glass, and Steve Emmert and I provide these oral argument audios for free as a public service. If you're a fan of the podcast, I'd love to send you my book, Renegade Lawyer Marketing, absolutely free. Just visit www.benglassreferrals.com and I'll be glad to ship it to you. This book has helped thousands of lawyers across the country improve their lives and their practices. Again, that's benglassreferrals.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy these oral arguments from the Supreme Court of Virginia.